And now on to our annual bird show. For the rest of the hour, we'll be answering your birding questions. You got questions? You like to watch birds? You want to know about where birds are migrating and what to be seeing this time of the year? We're going to be talking about the Audubon's annual Christmas bird count. We do this every year. It's very interesting. We love to continue doing it. It is the longest running volunteer-based bird census. Maybe you are part of that census. Give us a call if you want to talk about it. It runs from December 14th to January 5th each year. And this year, the researchers are looking north to the forests of Alaska and Canada, to the birds that breed there but winter in the U.S. How are they faring? Also, the 500 most important bird areas in the U.S. Is there one near you? Maybe it's in your backyard. Who knows? We'll talk about it. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Jeff LeBaron is the director of the National Audubon Society's Christmas Bird Count. He joins us today from his office in Williamsburg, Massachusetts. Welcome back to the program, Jeff.
It's great to be here, Ira. Happy holidays.
Happy holiday to you. Robert Chip Chipley is the co-author of the American Bird Conservancy Guide to the 500 Most Important Bird Areas in the United States, published by Random House. He's also director of the Important Bird Areas Program at the American Bird Conservancy in the Plains, Virginia. And he joins us today from our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ira. It's great to be here.
We're going to talk a lot about birds. We're going to get a lot of questions from our listeners. Let me ask you my own pet question, since I wonder about this all the time. I have at home, I've got a parakeet at home, and of course I know it's definitely a warm climate bird, but I know from listening over the years there are wild populations of parakeets, green monk parakeets. They live near my home in Connecticut. There's a legend that in the 1960s a container of these parakeets that are native to South America broke open at Kennedy Airport in New York, and several birds escaped, and these birds established wild populations on Long Island, and they spread to Connecticut. And there's another famous population of these birds in the Hyde Park neighborhood of Chicago, near the University of Chicago. So my question is, how can these parakeets, tropical birds from South America, how can they survive these North American winters? Jeff, Robert, want to take a shot at that and let us know?
Well, sure. Some of these birds, actually, I think that particular monk parakeet comes from a rather temperate climate in South America, and so it can put up with some fairly chilly scenarios. And, it seems to have spread quite a bit up and down the East Coast, at least. But there are many kind of little pockets of exotic parrots and parakeets in the U.S., mostly places like Miami and Los Angeles, where it is warmer.
That I can understand.
Sure.
I'd want to stay there, too, in the winter. But I guess they find...
I would, too.
I guess, Jeff, they find some place, a little niche to roost in?
Yep. Actually, a lot of parrots are able to survive unusually, or what we think of as would be unusually cold conditions. There are actually quite a number of high-altitude parrots in Latin America and live above tree line, actually, in the Andes. So... parrots themselves are actually pretty well adapted to cold weather, and they're incredibly intelligent, adaptive creatures. One of the things about the monk parakeets that help them a lot is these big piles of nests that they make are actually communal nests, and that it provides them a little bit of sanctuary for the super cold weather that can happen even in the windy city.
But this is not to say that you should take your store-bought little parakeet and let him out on his own to survive.
No, you certainly shouldn't.
Yeah. Let's talk about the bird count, Jeff. The count started nearly 2 weeks ago. How many counts have you been to?
I myself have been on two, and I'll be going on another one tomorrow. I know that people all over the country and continent and hemisphere really are doing Christmas bird counts, primarily on the weekends, although they do them really throughout the count period, just about on every day. One of my compilers, actually Kelly McKay in Iowa and Illinois, is attempting to do 23 different Christmas bird counts this year, one on each day of the period. So that's quite a marathon there.
And when you say a count, do you actually just go out and look with binoculars or something and count them?
What people do is they're organized. Everybody has a specific area, each individual count, and there are roughly 2,000 Christmas bird counts that are conducted each season, is done during a calendar day within a specific 15-mile diameter circle. And people are organized into groups and have specific areas and routes that they take, and they're actually counting every bird that they see and hear during the entire day. At the end of each count, people get together and have a countdown or a compilation party and sort of compare lists and make sure that they minimize any double counting and talk about all the great birds that they found or just horrible weather they had to endure.
I know in past years there were counts of your backyard feeder. Is that kind of counting still going on?
A component of the Christmas bird count certainly is feeder watching if people do live within count circles. Actually, at the end of the winter season, there's the Great Backyard Bird Count, which is conducted over President's Day, which is more geared specifically toward feeder watchers and counting birds at feeders and in yards, whatever, however you define your yard.
Yeah, it could be a big spot. So how long the count will go now to the first week in January?
Yep, it'll go through the 5th, and then we'll probably, you know, the data entry period goes through probably the end of February. Things will be reviewed by the regional editor team, and hopefully we'll have we're planning on having the publication out as last year during the summer.
All right, we're going to take a short break, everybody. Stay with us. You can check your backyard feeder. We're going to come back and talk lots more with Jeff LeBaron and Chip Chipley about the bird count and also about the 500 most important bird areas in the United States. And if you're a birder, you probably think yours is one. We'll find out. Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about birds and the bird count, the annual Audubon bird count that goes on between Christmas and New Year's and into the first week of the new year every year, with my guests, Robert Chip Chipley, co-author of the American Bird Conservancy Guide to the 500 Most Important Bird Areas in the United States. That's out this year from Random House. And Jeff LeBaron, director of the National Audubon Society's Christmas Bird Count, our number 1-800-989-8255. Jeff, has this the early snow that we've had this year up here in the Northeast, has that kept the birds away or the counters?
Well, it certainly impacts the ability of people to find counts or find birds during their CBC. I know that first the count that I was on December 14th here, we actually had to knock off sort of in the early afternoon just because it turned into blizzard conditions. But prior to that, we actually had very good conditions and found quite a few birds. We collect effort data so that scientists analyzing Christmas bird count data actually can see the number of party hours and party miles and the number of people that were out during the CBC, so that it actually all factors in and you can still get meaningful data. But the weather certainly does affect not only the birds but the bird watchers as well.
Mm-hmm.
Both on count day, actually, and during the weeks leading up to the count period.
Mm-hmm. Chip, tell us about your 500 most important bird areas. How do you choose what's an important bird area?
Well, we had a couple of main criteria for picking these areas. One is we were looking for areas that were important for endangered and threatened species, and also for diminishing species that are on the American Bird Conservancy green list. And we're also looking for important concentrations of birds, particularly migrant shorebirds and waterfowl and land birds that just either touch down or stay for a while in great, great numbers at a few different places.
Mm-hmm.
So every single site in the book fits into one of those two categories.
Is there a top 10 list, or are they just all the most equally important?
Well, I wouldn't call them equally important. We could probably come out with a top 10 list. We initially came out with a top 100 list, but someplace like Aransas National Wildlife Refuge, which has the only wild natural wintering population of the whooping crane, is certainly more important than, I'm not going to name some site and put it down, but some little spot along the Gulf Coast where you know, a bunch of birds may touch down for 3 days before they disappear into the boreal forest.
Yeah, we don't want to send all that mail to you. So
No, I don't want
to. Well, speaking of whooping cranes, let me go to Ray in Trucker, Ohio. Hi, Ray.
Hey, hello.
You saw a crane?
Yeah, and the odd thing about it was that I'm not used to seeing. I've seen crows and hawks and things like that, but what caught my eye was from the gully just on the side of the freeway, out jumped these huge or large flapping wings, and immediately, and he did a 360, And apparently, up going up towards the telephone pole to sit up there, to roost up there. And by then I passed him, and the last 20 minutes I had been wondering how I'm going to get this info to somebody, because this is, to me, it's an unusual sighting.
A crane on a telephone pole in Ohio.
Well, it looked like that's where it was going. It was between the 11th and 12th mile marker of I-70 of the freeway near the Indiana-Ohio border.
Huh. Jeff, is this unusual?
Well, that sounds unusual. First, let me say that I'm going to be driving out on that very road in about 4 or 5 days, so I'm going to look for that bird. The other thing is that, you know, sometimes great blue herons will perch on the roof of a house or maybe even a telephone pole. So, you know, there's at least the possibility that it might have been a great blue heron, which is a rather more common bird than a crane.
Yeah, I've seen them up north.
Well, this one had it looked like a crane to me, long legs and a very long neck.
It could be either one.
Oh, okay.
All right, Ray, why did the crane cross the road? Sorry. See you later. Have a good weekend. 1-800-989-8255. Some of these birds are hard to identify. I mean, I know. I watch birds, and they're hard, aren't they, Jeff?
Yeah, they can be, and especially, you know, birds that do look similar. And it's also, you know, bird watchers are known to be a little bit of a sort of a different group and avid in their passion and all that stuff, but we also do quite a bit of bird watching along the road when we ought to be paying attention to driving. So, when you're distracted by something and as it flies up and you're driving, sometimes it's hard to get exactly the right marks. But interestingly, though, just in terms of sandhill cranes, which is, if it was a crane, that's what it would have been, they are very similarly patterned to great blue herons, and they also are migrants throughout the Midwest and seem to be increasing in some areas. So you never know.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Is there a theme this year? Any kind of theme for the count, or are you just counting?
For the Christmas count, yeah. We're starting analyses right now on looking at the status of the birds of the boreal forest. The boreal forest is the evergreen forest that extends, as you mentioned in the intro, from central Alaska through Canada and to the Atlantic provinces. And there are indications, especially from some studies done by Pete Blanchard up in Canada, that some of the birds in the boreal forest that are breeding up there seem to be declining. And one of the great things about the Christmas bird count is the birds that move southward into the central and lower portions of North America are a lot of these boreal species that are actually quite familiar and common backyard birds and just, you know, birds that you see outside during the CBC period, like white-crowned and white-throated sparrows. And one of the ones that we're particularly wanting to look at are rusty blackbirds that seem to be declining a lot.
You know, we hear stories about, due to climate change, that trees are migrating in different areas. You know, the warmer trees are going north. Anything to do with birds? Could you look at the bird migration and see any evidence of global warming that way?
Well, I'm not sure. It's practically impossible to tell at this point what's causing these declines, if in fact they're there. What we want to actually do right now is document what is going on with these birds, because they have been counted for, you know, like you mentioned, the last 50 or 104 years in some areas on Christmas bird counts. So what we can do, analyzing CBC data, is look at any trend data that we might be finding in those species, and then sort of go back and look at what's been happening up in the boreal, and if there has been either forest products harvesting techniques that have changed in certain areas, or potential climate change, or alteration of habitat, or just something seems to be affecting a lot of these. And first we need to see what's happening if something's happening with the birds, and then try to figure out what we can do to address those problems.
Can I make a couple
Sure.
of comments here, too? In fact, I've read, as everyone has, about global climate change and birds. I mean, anybody interested in birds. And I believe there's some indication that some species are arriving back up in the north earlier than they were recorded too much in the past. And, I think that's another sign of possible changing climate. And, in fact, we've got a scientist at American Bird Conservancy who's been doing some modeling about predictive range shifts for birds breeding in the U.S., and it's actually kind of alarming. I mean, the, you know, how they're going to be moving farther north and breeding less far south, and it's hard to say what's going to happen, but whatever it is, it's likely not to be so great.
Yeah, and the other thing about, you know, the potential and apparent range shifting of some of these species is that if you breed in the northernmost habitat, and there's no place for you to go when that habitat disappears, because terrestrial habitats north of the boreal forest and tundra are just ocean. You know, the frozen Arctic Ocean or not so frozen Arctic Ocean anymore. And so birds further south or wildlife farther south, you know, have an opportunity to shift northward if necessary. But anything, if you're right on that northern fringe, you've got no place to go.
1-800-989-8255. Ann in Arizona. Hi, Ann.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I have had for the last 3 years some little western screech owls that have been nesting on my front porch. The first year I had one, the next year I had a pair, and last year they had two babies and only one survived. And then they disappeared. First the male disappeared and the baby and the mom stayed, and now they're all gone. I was wondering, do they migrate to Mexico during the wintertime?
Jeff, you have any idea? Screech owls?
Certainly screech owls do move around. I'm not sure myself whether western screech owls move south or whatever, but there's a lot of post-breeding dispersal in just about any species, even for relatively resident species. So it's entirely possible that they were just successfully fledged the one young and are off, and you may get them back again next year.
Thank you very much.
Good
they're
luck.
They're most enjoyable to watch.
Oh, they're wonderful birds.
Send them my way if you see them, okay?
I will. You know, there's a website for owls, and it's the most wonderful website for identifying owls, and that's how I figured out what they were. We have many types of owls here in Tucson, and that was the only way. And I'd heard their call at night. They have the most eerie call. It's not like what we think of as the hoo-hoo call of owls. And when I got on the website, you could hear the calls also on the website.
Well, what's it? Well, tell us what website that is.
I believe it's called the Owl Pages. But if you just get your search engine up and you look for owls, the page will come up, and you can also get their monthly or quarterly email letters, and you can order books through them at the same price that you would get from bookstores, but they also get some support to keep the page up that way.
Thank you very much, and have a happy New Year.
You too.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Chip, does each important area in your book of the 500, do they contain endangered bird species?
Well, I would say well over half of them contain either endangered, threatened, or birds that are on this green list, which represent those species we think are declining. And it's something like that. Let me just also quickly remark that if you'd like to see a list of the 500 sites, you can go to American Bird Conservancy's website, which is abcbirds.org. And, of course, we'd be only too happy if people would go out and actually take a look at and consider purchasing the book, which has long, long descriptions of each one of these, or at least fairly long descriptions of each of the sites, along with why we've included it.
You've identified sites in every state, but you've really organized them according to 35 bird conservation regions. Why is that?
Well, ornithologists have been trying to come up with natural groupings, geographical groupings of birds in order to kind of define some of the conservation problems. And it just makes sense, rather than dealing with state boundaries, that they try to draw boundaries that are ecologically meaningful. So, in other words, we treat all the birds of the Great Basin together and all the birds of the Appalachian Mountains together, whether they're in North Carolina or Virginia or Tennessee, and then all the birds of the southeastern coastal plain, whether they're in the areas are in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, or wherever. And it's just a much more natural way to group the sites.
Let's go to Gail in Massachusetts. Hi, Gail.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question for Dr. Chipley. My question regards blue jays and whether West Nile virus could threaten them to such a degree that it could cause their extinction. I say that because last summer we had about five pairs of blue jays that were raising their babies and bringing them to the feeders. And I called Audubon because I was worried suddenly, you know, we started seeing, you know, less and less of them. And they said it would have been too early for them to have started migrating. And, you know, I would see them on the ground. They couldn't fly. And then, you know, you just didn't see them. So it really worried me. And I just wondered if that was, you know, if there was a concern.
Let me just first remind everybody that we're talking about birds this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. West Nile virus? Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I'm you know, I'm really not sure of the answer to that. But people have noticed that certain species seem to have declined, at least locally and at least temporarily, like the crow population around Washington, D.C. seem to have practically dried up and disappeared for a while, although now somehow there seem to be plenty of crows around. So I'm really not quite sure how to answer that question.
You know, Gail, I haven't seen many blue jays in my neighborhood either.
Yeah.
I
didn't know whether it was just local or if that was happening in other places.
Well, it could be local, but I doubt that any species is going to be driven to extinction by that.
Right.
If
I might,
not something.
Jeff, go ahead.
If I might jump in, we actually did some analyses last year immediately following the Christmas bird count period and the 103rd count, looking at the effects of West Nile on regional populations of American crows and blue jays, and also chickadees and black-capped chickadees and red-tailed hawks and great horned owls, which are among the birds that seem to be most drastically affected by West Nile, at least on local populations on a local basis. The sort of good news was that in the analyses that we did initially, we didn't find any dramatic declines on a continental basis for any of the species. But it's really hard, as Chip said, to be exactly sure of what's going on a regional basis, especially looking at birds on, you know, in the winter season versus what's happening in the summer when, of course, the West Nile is affecting them. We do know that West Nile virus is nearly 100% fatal in American crows in terms of the birds that actually get the disease. So American crows actually seem to be, at least in terms of the studies that have been done so far on specific species, the American crow is taking the hardest hit. But like you say, you know, some years they're gone, and next year they seem to come back. So I would hope that, you know, the populations will rebound and eventually birds will begin to survive and pass on the survival genes.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the one more call before a break. Hi, Greg in San Diego. Hi, Greg.
Hi, good morning. Happy holidays.
Thank you.
My question is rather pedestrian, perhaps, but it has to do with one of the most common birds and how it interacts or survives in the same environment as man, and that is, frankly, pigeons. You know, their habitat, is it mainly or almost always connected to populated areas? Are they carnivorous or herbivorous? Where do they find places to nest, root, breed, and so forth?
And die. Where you never see dead pigeons around, do you?
That's true. In terms of, is it good to feed them or not feed them?
All right, let me see if I can get an answer in before the break.
Sure.
Jeff, you have any?
Well, pigeons, feral pigeons, are actually descended from a species in Africa called the rock dove, or now called rock pigeon, which their natural breeding habitat actually were cliffs. So one of the reasons they do so well around buildings and cities and also under bridges is because those are you know, similar kinds of habitats to cliffs. To answer your question about what do they eat, they're mostly eating grains and things like that. And they're just really adaptable, critters.
With millions of them here in New York, you never see dead. Where do they go to die someplace? Or what happens to them?
Dead birds in general are even when you have a very common species in a fairly large bird, even like a pigeon or bigger, they're actually, it's amazing how quickly they disappear. I think they get eaten quickly by scavengers and stuff like that.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note. Join Neil Conan and his guests on Monday in this hour for a look ahead at the foreign policy challenges for next year, the year 2004. We're talking this hour about birds and birding. My guests are Jeff LeBaron, director of the National Audubon Society's Christmas Bird Count in Williamsburg, Massachusetts. Robert Chip Chipley, co-author of the American Bird Conservancy Guide to the 500 Most Important Bird Areas in the United States. That's out this year from Random House. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go back to the phones. A lot of people love to talk about birds. Let's go to Ron in Indiana. Hi, Ron.
Hi. My wife and I live in southern Indiana in the woods, and we love the birds. We feed them year-round, and a lot of woodpeckers around here. But the problem is they're eating one end of our house, so I was looking for some kind of suggestions to help the birds find someplace else to eat other than my house.
Any comment on woodpeckers?
I wish I knew the answer to that question, because I've got a woodpecker that's been pecking away at my house for about 2 years right now, and has put several holes into the wood on the side near the kitchen. So maybe Jeff has some good idea as to how to protect your house from woodpeckers.
I always heard that if you have carpenter ants, they're looking for that in the wood or something.
If you do have some sort of pest like carpenter ants or something like that, or you know, if there's a bee's nest underneath your siding, then obviously that could be part of it. But oftentimes in the fall, what happens is young birds, the birds of the year, kind of young and stupid. They don't really know. I mean, they know they're supposed to peck, but they're not sure exactly what they're supposed to peck on. And when they start going on siding, it makes a lot of great noise, and it yeah. can be like a super stimulus for them. Sometimes what people can have tried to do with some success is put up strips of aluminum foil or cloth just to discourage them from going to an area.
Ron, is it aluminum siding that they're pecking in?
No, it's cedar siding.
Yeah.
I've read a bunch of stuff on the web and went to a pest place in Indianapolis and talked to them, and I've got an owl hanging up, and I've got strips of it's like aluminum foil garland, and I've put suet feeders away from the house, and now I've bought a spider that sounds. It drops down and makes a noise and then crawls back up this line. So there's stuff I guess you can
wow.
spray on, but
you give them something else to eat. That's what you know. I have a bird feeder that has five kinds of woodpeckers on it, and they're all it's just black seeds there in there, and they love it.
So yeah,
maybe if you give them something else.
Two locations I put suet feeders at back away from the house, and I haven't seen them in about a week since I put the garland up, and tomorrow I'm going to get out there and put the spider up and see if that has any effect on them, but.
Good luck.
I'm at an age where I don't want to be climbing up this ladder to get up high enough to repair all these holes. A friend of mine repaired several of them, but anyway.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Try the seed instead of the suet. It works for me. Terrific. So.
Okay, great.
Good luck.
Just oilers?
Yeah, plain old sunflower oiler seed.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
What am I giving out advice for? I got two experts here. Gentlemen.
I love that. I love the mechanical spider solution. I think
yeah.
I'm going to try that myself.
A spider yo-yo.
I wanted my wife to sit out there with a broom next to the house, but she refused to cooperate.
Some people also set up a garden hose, and you know, when the birds show up, just go out and try to spray them. I mean, you just need to dissuade them somehow.
Well, in the middle of the wintertime, that's not the solution of choice for me, I don't think.
No.
Let me ask you, Chip, on your 500 sites, are they sites limited to national parks or other protected lands, or could they be anywhere? You know, could they be in a lot someplace nearby your home?
Well, they're likely to be the larger places, and actually the biggest single ownership are national wildlife refuges. I think roughly a third of all the sites are refuges, and then about 60% of the sites are federal lands, also national parks and national forests and grasslands and military bases. And it turns out that military bases are some of the most important sites of all. And let me just say that from what I've found out, the military is doing an excellent job in managing habitat in several different places for endangered species.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's about 25 or 30% that are state lands. And then there's some Nature Conservancy preserves and other conservation group preserves. And then there's a smattering of private lands as
right.
well.
I always find it fascinating here in New York. There's a huge park right next to JFK, the airport. It's a wetland. It's a terrific bird site.
Well, that's an important bird area, Jamaica Bay.
Yeah.
That's in the book. I used to go out there quite a bit.
And actually, even Central Park is a wonderful bird area, too. So.
Oh, yeah.
It is. Don't forget Prospect Park in Brooklyn, too. We need to mention that.
Right. All the parks in New York.
Right.
It's interesting. I haven't actually sat down and done it, but I think there's a lot of overlap between IBA areas and IBAs and Christmas bird count circles. Obviously, you know, it's not necessarily a one-to-one correlation, but just in terms of monitoring activities, both the national IBAs and also state IBAs, which is, a slightly different program, oftentimes are contained within Christmas bird count circles.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to hopefully sunny Miami. Hi, Joseph.
Hey, Ira. How are you?
What's the temperature today in Miami?
Well, lousy weather. It's sunny and 75.
I hate it.
My question is, if you would ask your guests if they take a minute away from their serious study and reflect or give us some funny stories in reference to their choices of life's work, and perhaps maybe something like, did the reindeer that fly around the country every Christmas ever get on anybody's lists for counts, or something that they think is...
You got a funny story that he can relate to...
Well, I don't know that it's really a funny story, but the way I originally got interested in birds and started my bird list was it was almost like a revelation. It was on Valentine's Day many, many years ago, and I was walking up to Sunday school, and the block right north of my house, there was a snowy owl sitting on the television aerial, and it was being pestered by crows flying around. And when I went home, I did have a bird book in the house. I looked it up, and within a week, I was out in the park trying to identify other birds as well.
Joseph?
So that's how I got started.
Interesting. Joseph, do you get to the Everglades a lot?
Oh, we do. And I think one of the funniest things that I've ever seen is we didn't know what kind of bird it was. And I imagine it was a woodpecker. We were out there with a group of friends and relatives. And there was a steel flagpole for some reason in the middle of the Everglades that wasn't being used. And this bird attached itself to it and furiously started knocking its beak into it and fell over several times. It perched, and it made this horrific noise like shattering glass or metal, like you can imagine.
Wow.
And the bird fell on the ground, and then several times it attempted it, and we never knew, found out if the bird actually figured out what to do after that, but it was one of the most hilarious things that we've ever experienced with birds.
That's funny.
Probably the world's best drumming post.
Well, I had never really been a bird watcher until I went to the Everglades a few years ago, and I just fell in love with bird watching. What is the state of birds in the Everglades? Jeff, are they surviving there, thriving, or...?
Well, the Everglades, fortunately, have had a lot of conservation interest for a long time. It was sort of one of the original fights for the conservation community. And actually, things seem to be going pretty well in the Everglades. There's a lot of work being done on Everglade restoration, and the birds, the wildlife in general in the Everglades is doing well. I actually went to college at the University of Miami, when I was interviewing down there, looking at colleges before I actually decided to go there, I've always been a loving birds, and I was down in Florida for the first time with my parents to look at the university, and we went out to the Rosenstiel School on Virginia Key, and there's like one rock out there on all the sandy keys, and I looked on the rock, and there's one duck standing on the rock, and this is in Florida, and it was a harlequin duck. And now a harlequin duck is a species that's usually found in the far north, and I had never seen a harlequin duck in my life, and I turned to my parents and I said, hey, there's a harlequin duck down there. And they looked at me like I was, like, totally nuts. But it was a harlequin duck, and it turns out it was a drake harlequin that showed up down there for 2 years, and I believe it was the first state record.
Wow.
Of course the Everglades are a supremely important place, but from what we know of it and kind of the research I did into it when we were putting together the account for the Everglades, it said that there used to be 250,000 herons and whatnot, wading birds in the Everglades, and that in the past few years it's plunged down to 20 to 30,000.
No kidding.
Which is a hell of a drop.
Wow.
And the other problem that the Everglades has been experiencing for a long time is the invasion by non-native plants, things like Brazilian pepper and this old world climbing fern that's a house plant that's gone wild in the Everglades. And so, you know, the place definitely is a wonderful place, but it's got its problems.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the birds this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's go to Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hi, Bob. Bob, are you there? Oh, Bob. Last, Bob, well, 3, 2, 1, sorry. Do you suspect that, getting back to the Everglades question, that this is going to continue, you know, or is it going to are we into a recovery, or is it, you think it's going to continue to decline like that?
Well, I think that these invasive plants are continuing to spread. I mean, controlling non-native plants is a very difficult thing. So,
and the plants take away the food or the habitat, or
well, what they do is they cover up the ground,
and
they're not necessarily suitable for birds to feed on. Brazilian pepper seems to be, but that's one of the main problems, is that they occupy space.
Yeah, and they exclude the native species also.
Right,
of
exactly.
The other thing with the Everglades. Sort of a combined thing are water level issues in terms of there's historically, with all the diversion of water for cultivation and just drainage in the central part of the state, that cut off most of the water supply to the Everglades itself, which is essentially just, I mean, as they call it, the giant river of grass. And the residual water that was coming in, a lot of it had a lot of nasty runoff from all the cultivation, especially the sugar industry in Central Florida. So a lot of the issues that are there, I mean, and there are still some very serious issues to be dealt with in the Everglades, have to do with maintaining water levels and also controlling the quality of the runoff. Mm.
Jonathan in Iowa, you've got the last call quickly.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to comment that I'll be working at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge, but I won't be counting the birds. I'm going to be cooking the food for the bird counters, and I decided chicken was not the thing to serve tomorrow.
How about turkey?
Turkey? We have turkeys on the refuge. And well, to me, the most fascinating birds are the raptors, and to have seen several turkey vultures on a carcass, why, that was the most spectacular thing I've ever seen with birds.
How many counters do you have to cook for?
Well, we're going to plan on 20 and hope we get them. It's going to be warm, but it's going to be terribly windy.
Oh.
Some people think that the birds or the Christmas bird count are the main reason for people going on CBCs, and for a lot of people, I think the main reason that they go is just exactly for the compilation dinner. So I thank you very much. You serve an important purpose.
It's the most fun there possibly can be.
All right. Well,
I agree entirely, having been on many, many Christmas counts.
Have a happy bird time.
You too, and have a good weekend. We've run out of time. I'd like to thank all my guests. Chip Chipley, co-author of the American Bird Conservancy Guide to the 500 Most Important Bird Areas in the U.S. That's out this year from Random House. He's also director of the Important Bird Areas Program at the American Bird Conservancy in Plains, Georgia, in the Plains, Virginia. And
Virginia,
Jeff,
yes.
Thank you, the Plains, Virginia. I'm thinking of Jimmy Carter. Jeff LeBaron, director of the National Audubon Society's Christmas Bird Count in Williamsburg, Massachusetts. Thank you. And good luck with the bird count.
Well, thank you, and thank you for being on, Chip.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it. It was great.
Earlier we spoke with Tom Clark of Channel 4 News in London. Our program. Today's program is produced by Annette Heist, Erica Ilton, and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our director and our web producer. Please surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you'll find Science Friday's Kids Connection. We make free curricula based on what we talk about on Science Friday, teaching materials for students and their teachers. Also, you can get archival editions of Science Friday if you missed back programming. You can listen to them to those programs on Real Audio, or you can download them onto your audible.com player. And also you can leave us email at sciencefriday.com. And any of the links we talk about, we'll have them up for you. If you missed them, where to go and visit them on the website, we'll have them up for you as soon as we can. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.